Welcome to our special 10-year anniversary podcast series. I'm Stefan.
And I'm Paul.
And we're your hosts. We started Stories We Don't Tell with our good friend Brian Bennis back in 2014.
And from the beginning, we've been recording all the stories. So for this series, we went back through our archives and picked stories from 10 storytellers, one from each year.
And each episode, we'll chat with one of the tellers and hear a story from them. On today's episode, we're talking with Georgette Stubbs. Georgette, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
By way of introduction, in case, you know, the listeners now haven't dug back into our 145 episode archives, which they should do as an aside, but in case they haven't, I'm wondering if you can give us a quick intro to yourself and what you do.
For work, I do career and business coaching. I help people design work to fit their lives. And I got into storytelling because I was trying to find ways to process stories or difficult things that I'd been through. And I had seen somebody else tell a hard story and I wanted to try it. So I then ended up telling a series of stories with Stories We Don't Tell. And that's how we got connected. So those are two things that I do, what I do for work and what I've done with Stories We Don't Tell.
Perfect.
Yeah. And this is always my favorite. You're my favorite kind of guest because you just lead us right seamlessly into the next question with your answer. And because that's what I was curious about is that you did when you showed up at one of our workshops, you really had an intention with what you were kind of doing. You had a goal. Can you maybe just I'm curious, like how you came to that first workshop and what you were looking to kind of develop as a storyteller and that kind of thing.
Yes. So I came to the first workshop in 2019 after I had spent a year away from Canada taking care of my dad after he passed away. And I wanted to spend some time I spent some time reflecting and just taking some downtime, not working. And before I left Canada, I had went to just one of your events because people kept telling me about it. So I was like, okay, let me check this out. It was held at CSI and I heard people tell stories and I just gravitated to one of the stories about somebody losing their grandmother. And when I returned, I started dating somebody and he was like, I want to write a book. I want to tell stories. And we decided that we would tell the story together. So we would tell stories together. And we went to a storytelling workshop that you were hosting. I think it was at your house, Paul. And we knocked on the door, not sure if it was the right place at all.
What are these guys? What is this all about? Yeah. What are we getting ourselves into?
Exactly. Not sure if it was the right address. And I actually remember listening to the door, seeing if I was hearing anybody speak. It was silent. And I was like, I'm just going to try it. And then you came to the door and I had vaguely remembered your faces, remembered it from the website. And it was just the two of us at that particular workshop. But I remember just kind of unloading a story on you. And you're like, okay, well, I think I tried to give you an easy story. But it wasn't really about me. It was one of my nephews. And you called me out on that. You said, this isn't about you. This is about your nephew. Now tell us a story about you. Mm. And I did. I think I started off with a story that happened a long time ago when I was 8 years old. And then eventually I moved into more recent things as I started to process them for myself.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that. About that, because I remember because Paul and I think we're sitting around being like, is no one gonna come? Like, which is the funny thing about doing this kind of thing, especially then we didn't ask for RSVPs, we just sort of sent out a message, and then just once or twice no one came. Mm-hmm. It was rarely, but once or twice no one came. And then it's like, all right, two people, oh, great, all right, well, let's do this thing that we do. All right, here we go. But From that jump, I mean, clearly you told one and then you came back a bunch of times. And so I'm curious, what was it about your experience that made you want to keep telling stories? You know, like how did that after that first one, what brought you to keep coming back?
I knew I wanted to know how to tell my story and I didn't know where the beginning, middle and end of a story was. So people always found when I talk about my life, it was interesting and they wanted to hear more. People were telling me I should write a book, but I didn't know how to structure a story. I didn't know where to start, where to end, like what pieces to choose as relevant as I was like telling the story. Like what sounds I heard, what sensations, all of those things. And you two had helped probably with hundreds of people at this point tell stories. So you were able to give me all of this feedback and I would come with some really hard stories and you're like, okay, let's talk about this. And you had pretty good reactions. Most people would feel so much discomfort in hearing some of the stories that I was telling. But I was okay with talking about them and figuring out how to parse through them if somebody was willing to sit with me and do that. And you were hosting these workshops that were like extremely accessible. If I just was willing to come in and tell a story. So each week I came in and I told, each month I came in and I told a story for most of 2019. Mm. And then I think I came back in 2021. I left Canada again for a while and then I came back and did it again.
It's really great to hear that we were a part of your process and development in that kind of way. For you, you know, you mentioned the different kind of stories that you did sort of talk about and the that sometimes they're, you know, difficult, not difficult, but like they're challenging stories, I think, for you to share and for, you know, to stand up in front of an audience. Like where I just feel I mean, I just have such an appreciation and respect that you were able to, that you wanted to do this at our event and you did share a lot of these stories. What were you feeling or thinking at the time with some of these things that you were talking about? If you can bring us back in time during that period.
I remember when I chose my first story, it was about being robbed when I was 8 years old, my parents getting robbed and me briefly being suffocated. And I had told this story to friends before, but I'd never really told it to a larger audience. And but I remember it was interesting because the story had a twist. It didn't end the way people expected it to. And my connection and my feelings towards the robber aren't ones that like are associated with significant fear. And so people always thought that was a bit odd. And it was far enough away, so I was comfortable talking about it right off the bat. And so I started there. And then when I told the story, the response was really positive. I did tweak the story a lot. I read it. I wasn't comfortable acting my stories out. I just was reading them with a very flat, like monotone voice. That's just where I was at. Mm. But the audience was so positive. And I don't think there was no microphone to amplify my voice. And I'm often very soft spoken and people just got really quiet and they listened. And it was cool to see so many people listening to a story, because when you think there are these parts of yourself that you have to hide or that you're not allowed to talk about, to go into a room full of people and then tell that story can be very liberating from that experience. You're no longer hiding in like shame or guilt or silence around it, but you're allowing yourself to be much more open. So that's what I've appreciated most from the storytelling experience. And then when I came back and I told a story again, I started to get into slightly more recent events. I think I went back maybe 10 years instead of 15 or 20. And I slowly started to creep up into more and more recent events as I started to tell stories. And it was interesting watching people respond. Some of my stories were really heavy and I could tell people just didn't know how to respond. They heard them and they listened and they were there and they just didn't know what to say. And so they just said they appreciated me opening up, or they didn't say anything, which was okay. Mm-hmm. And it was also interesting because I remember there was somebody in the group who always talked about how he hated hearing heavy stories. And he struggles with the event because there's a lot of heavy stories that are told at the event. It's not just heavy stories, though. You have funny stories about sex and life, and so it's just the taboo, the things that we don't talk about normally. So I found it interesting because I bumped into him when I was in Toronto recently, and he was like, "You told really good stories." And I said, "But don't you hate hard stories?" He's like, "Yeah, I do." But you still were a really good storyteller.
You broke through the bias, you know? There's some people don't want to hear the hard, but if you still do well, you know, game recognizes game in a way, right? You're just like, that was still well done.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to pick up on something you just said, because it's, to me, one of the more interesting reactions that we experience in this type of storytelling that is not... sort of doesn't exist in many other places, which is the silence of people listening. Because like, there's something about telling a funny story where you can always tell if the audience is with you because they laugh. You know, like, you stop at a beat, people laugh, and you're like, ah, people are listening. This is great. But whenever I would tell a hard story and people were just dead silent for 10 minutes, it was such a different experience. Because you could never, like, you had to trust they were with you. And because they were so quiet, you believed that they were too locked in. But you just never had that release valve of like, we are here, you know, you are here listening to the story. Because when you keep in that space. And so, yeah, I'm wondering if you can reflect on that. And as you mentioned also, because it's, you know, not microphoned, you're just in the space, everyone is just has to be quiet so they can hear people. Like, we were doing some of these stories in living rooms that were like big enough that if like a car drove by behind us, you wouldn't be able to hear the person speaking. And so it was, you know, the silence to me is a part of the event that you never hear just on the podcast. But yeah, I wonder if you can talk about that. Like, what's that experience of talking to a room that is so quiet, but because they're listening?
I think it is a bit easier because I read my stories. I read them and I wasn't trying to perform or elicit a response right away. And I never expected a joke. Like, I know when I get on stage and I speak to people, I've done it many times before, I'm always the one that it can elicit emotions from people, but I'm not necessarily the one to get the biggest laugh. And I'm okay with that. That's just not my personality. I make people laugh one-on-one. And that's okay. So when I'm sitting, when I'm standing there and telling a story for 10 to 15 minutes and people are just there quietly listening, when it's a room full of like 60 people, I usually take it as a compliment they're there and they're trying that hard to listen to me. And then the silence that can come afterwards, like, they're sitting with me and everybody else who's telling a story, and they're going on a roller coaster of emotions depending on what we're bringing to them with no real idea of what's coming. Like, I don't even know.
We don't even have a theme, right? Like, we're not even like, oh, this is all about dating stories or something like that.
Like, whatever might happen, good luck.
Yeah.
And you two are pretty good at creating some sort of emotional, like, roller coaster that feels good and trying to end on a lighter note. But it is a roller coaster of emotions that people get taken on within each story and then within the event as a whole. So when people are sitting there and they're listening, that is some emotional labor that they're often doing to listen to those hard stories. And their silence is them trying to pay attention to you. So I take it as a compliment that they're there. I know that if they felt really uncomfortable, they could step away. And usually I try to end the story on a okay note, like, I'm okay, I'm here.
Well, I know you're saying, like, are not necessarily going for the laughs or like going, you're reading, But I feel like that's a real testament to how powerful your stories are, and how incredible your writing and how powerful your writing is, that that people are, you're just from the start, they're like, okay, this is a different, we're in a different place here than a lot of the other kind of stories. How do you, for you now, because I feel like also so much, like since then, so much of what you've done involves storytelling. I think a lot of like your, you know, you've done a lot of work, you've done podcasting yourself, you've done like even just like the work that you do with clients. And I'm curious, after, from where you started and you walked into that first workshop up until even like now, how do you feel it's changed, and how do you feel it's you've developed as a storyteller in whatever that means to you, you know, now?
For sure. It's evolved substantially, and it's had several iterations. So I would say the first iteration was definitely feeling like I was being guided by the both of you in telling my stories and getting feedback. I know you say I had storytelling skills, but I really did not know where the beginning, middle, and end of the story was. And it was really helpful to be able to learn for myself how to pull out which pieces of my story constituted one story or one core message. And once I did that, I was able to start to share that with other people. So what I found was a lot of like people of color felt comfortable talking to me, and they were curious like how I got into storytelling or what I was doing with it. And so I started with Veronica, who I think will be one of your speakers as well, Veronica yeah. Antipolo. We did Mosaic Untold Lives, and we had people, women of color, come in and tell their stories. And we basically facilitated a space very similar to what you were doing. It's just that they didn't know if two white guys were going to create a safe space for them.
Sure.
Yeah.
And for some of them, I did refer them to you, and they went in, they were like, oh, it's great. And then others were just like, no, I'm not sure. And I found that there was this ability that we had as other women of color to give them permission to tell stories. Like there were times when women would come and they'd want to tell a story at an event, but they said, I can't say this in public, or I can't talk about this in public. This I experienced like racism here, but I can't say this in a room full of white people. And we're like, yeah, this is the perfect time to say this.
Yeah, right.
So we were able to give them permission, and there was just this basic trust because of a shared experience that allowed us to tell a story, tell our stories, but also to give them space to tell theirs. And some of those women went on to start writing their own books. They went on to start therapy for the first time because something that they never talked about, like the death of a loved one or how they were processing it and trying to cover it up, all of these things just started to bubble up to the surface. And they were like, oh, these are things that I can talk about, and here are avenues for me to talk about them. And then I started working, well, I was using Stories We Don't Tell to write stories that stood on their own that I could use as a portion of my own book, which I drafted in like 2019, 2020, that walked through how to design work to fit your life when you've experienced like significant trauma and you're trying to figure out your relationship with money and your relationship with your own self-worth and just ability to survive. Like if you come from historically oppressed societies or you come from environments where it was low income, how do you shift your relationship with money? Because you'll have certain internalized narratives like money is evil. I have to deal with a certain level of crap to make money, or somebody will mistreat me, or money causes divide. And these internal narratives, I started to get people to one, label them and then shift their stories around them. And then in a practical level, teach them the how to. I think it was around 2019, 2020, as I was doing this work with you, I started doing some like pro bono work with some clients who had come from low income communities in Toronto. And they were all people of color who were trying to access higher paying jobs. And most of them had been through some recent significant trauma. Like one person he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and both of his parents had a stroke within a 6 month time frame. So it was a lot on top of coming from a low income community, not making a lot of money, but being the first in his family to get a degree and put himself through school. So the first time I helped him get a job interview, it was for his dream job for $120,000. And he was at $40,000 before. So this was huge. And he just started shaking in our interview prep. And there was such a discomfort, like, I don't deserve this, or I am lying about who I am. This resume isn't me. And we went through and I said, did you do all these things? He's like, yes, but there's no way I'd be able to access this job. Like, there was just this disbelief. And then I saw it happen again and again. And I realized that there were certain like money narratives or stories that people were telling about themselves that was limiting how much they can access. And then there were people who were coming to me. Some of them were like working in like the nonprofit space. It's like, well, I have to take less so that I can do good in the world. And there were just certain beliefs where you can't do good in a sustainable way where you can actually fund yourself. So I helped people start to shift their narratives around wealth, around how they see their own trauma. I started moving people away from shame and guilt and silence and into sharing their stories more openly. And I started eventually, as I started telling my stories, I started to get in somatic and therapeutic practices along with storytelling so that I can help people calm down their body physically as they tell and share hard stories. And that helps them when they're going out to interview or when they're going to negotiate their worth in the world, because expectation management and negotiating your worth influences the type of people that you marry as well, right? Like, how are you negotiating what type of relationship dynamics you're setting for yourself, how you should be treated, and who do you think that you're worthy of attracting? Because you could totally reject somebody who's attracted to you because you think you're not worthy, or you think, no, they'd never be attracted to me, and you just won't even try. So I found clients were then telling me, you're not just helping me make more money, you're helping me do like deeper identity work. And you are helping me have better relationships with my family members and loved ones. And so it was much more holistic life coaching, but I've been hesitant to call it life coaching, but I'm kind of slowly moving into that. But I do focus on financial sustainability, because if you don't have financial sustainability, it's hard to access the therapy and all the other resources that people work with adjacent to working with me, because I do direct them to like a wraparound support system to help shift their life.
All of the things that you're talking about is so interesting that it makes it always, not every step of the way, whether, you know, it was moving into your Mosaic event or working or doing your own, working on your own book, working on your own podcast, working with your clients, that storytelling was such an important part of all of this. It just always made sense to me because, like you said, and I think this connects to what you were talking about earlier, just with your own experiences of storytelling that. You know, we're all living with these things locked in our heads. So then when you, it's just, and I don't even mean in a therapeutic way, but just being able to get it out and to, you know, connect it to other people, it helps sort of not like process, but also just to have a better understanding of who you are. And like you said, it relates to so many things, relationships, money, jobs, work, employment, all this stuff. So it always made sense, all of the storytelling and what you've done with it. It's quite incredible, I think.
Thank you. But it did start with walking into your apartment, Paul, and speaking to you.
Hey, listen, all we did was say, just start the story here and end it here, and that's it. We had nothing to do with it.
Had you actually knocked, you know, like had you not knocked.
it's funny just thinking about all of this, like over 10 years of all the people that have come through the door. It's like we never know who is going to come through the door. Yep. And this is so amazing that you did walk through the door and that we've had this ongoing relationship with you in so many different ways. And that it's changed in itself. It's great. So we're very happy you walked through the door.
Yeah, exactly. Because I mean, we always did think a little bit about how much like inviting people to their house was so specific, right? The people who would agree to actually go to a random person's house to do this, you know, did have its, was, I mean, it made it, allowed to make it free. It allowed for all of the warmth in ways that it did work, but it also was a barrier. You know, like there certainly the, an extra bit of intention to be like, no, I'm going to go and knock on this door, you know, and hopefully when it opens, it's people I expect to see. And then we'll have this conversation. So we're going to go to one of your stories in just a second, but I'm curious if you have any wrap-up thoughts in terms of sort of how you sort of now look back on the stories that you've told and those stories and whether or not hopefully we can hear one of your stories again.
I think about it positively. I made a lot of new connections and I got the opportunity to speak to so many interesting people. Veronica and I talk like every other month or so, we're still quite connected. So I've made some lifelong friends and I still stay connected to the two of you. So it's been great for building connections with people, but when you're building connections from a place where people are just opening up and being vulnerable and you have a space where you can talk about anything and it's safe, it creates a safe space to be and to be seen. And a lot of people don't get the ability to be seen often in their lives. They're often in a place of hiding. So it was refreshing to have that space regularly available and so accessibly available. And I would encourage people, if they're thinking about telling a story, to come out and tell it. Because I told like these stories that were sort of like life-shifting moments for the most part for me. But some people would come and tell stories of simple things that happened in their lives. And not everybody needed to have this dramatic experience. It was just like, what are the things that you're not saying out loud? And I think that's just really powerful to acknowledge that we could all be in very different places in life, but still come together and share and feel valued and seen, although we're all experiencing different things.
It's funny. You have just in that last sentence given me the answer for what story I will tell 10-year anniversary. I now have to go write it, but thanks so much. This has been Georgette, and here is one of her stories that she told.
I was about 8 years old as I prepared to walk into the police station. I held my mother's hand tightly as the police officer explained, "There will be 6 men. If you see the man, point him out to us and tell us which number he is wearing." I pulled my mother with me as he led me to the door. "No, you have to go by yourself," he said. "You'll be all right. They can't see you, only you can see them." "They won't see her at all? Are you sure the mirror works?" my mother said. He nodded, her lips shaking as tears ran down her cheeks. I released her hand and walked in. I was outside my parents' house on an island in the Caribbean. It was late in the afternoon, and my brother and I were trying to build a tent the way we saw the white people doing on TV. We had a clothesline, rocks, and my mom's good sheets. But the wind kept blowing our tent of sheets down. We were getting frustrated, and we started fighting about how to keep the tent up. Eventually, my brother got angry and went inside to sit on my mom's lap and play computer solitaire with her. I knew I was right about how to build a tent. I stayed outside into the evening to finish building the tent to show my brother and to spite him. As it got dark, I finally stood between two sheets, forming a tense peak along the clothing line, only slightly waving in the air. I knew I was right about how to build a tent. I turned to the house to get my brother. I saw two masked men walking up to the front door, dressed in all black and hiding behind the banana tree that led to the patio and my front door. They crouched under the banana tree. "Pull your mask down," the one with the gun whispered to his partner. I froze and took a deep breath. Under the clothesline, I was still hidden by the tent. If I backed away slowly without being heard, I could follow the secret path along the wall to the neighbor's window and ask them to call the police. I took a step back and leaves crackled under my feet. Both men looked over at me in the dark. "I thought you said the kids were inside," said the masked one with the gun, "and I told you to pull down your mask." I thought everyone was inside, the other man said as he pulled down his mask over his mustache. As I watched them watch me, I opened my mouth to shout to my parents, but nothing came out. I opened my mouth wider, nothing. My feet were frozen and heavy. Grab her and take her to the bushes until I'm done, said the man with the gun. Every lecture my mother ever gave me about things men could do to you in the bushes flashed in front of me. I knew it was time to fight. I opened my mouth wider to scream to warn my parents and barely heard my own muffled squeak as his large hands covered my mouth. He pulled me back into his chest, silencing me. I kicked frantically, but my feet struggled to touch the top of the grass. I tried to scream again. He tightened his grip over my mouth, and this time he covered my nose too. He made it about two steps, and suddenly my feet hit solid ground. I pushed back with all my might. She doesn't want to go to the bushes. She's fighting me, he said. The man with the gun grunted in frustration. Bring her inside then. My feet hung inches above the ground as he carried me across the patio, the front door open and waiting for me. The man with the gun walked in first, and from the far corner of the room, Daddy looked up from his newspaper. My brother was still on Mommy's lap, playing solitaire at the computer, their backs to the door. She turned around. Holy shit. I gripped both of my hands over his one hand and pulled down as hard as I could. His arm didn't even budge. It was like he couldn't even feel me. The one with the gun walked toward my father. We're here for the money. Take me to the safe. My dad cleared his throat. I felt my eyes widen as I struggled to breathe, and I kicked and pulled at the mustache man's arm. I looked at Mommy as I felt two tears run down my cheeks. She was watching the man with the gun. I kicked once to catch her eye. Oh my God, you're suffocating her. You're suffocating her. Please stop. Put her down, please. She looked me in the eyes. One arm clenched my brother and the other reaching for me in the distance. His muscles relaxed and my feet finally touched the floor. As he released my mouth and nose and turned my face up and to the left to look at his, I saw his eyes widen through the holes of his mask. I'm so sorry. Are you okay? He said as I gasped for breath. Are you okay? I nodded and gasped confused, looking at his mask. Mommy's voice shook. Can she come and sit with me? Please give me my child. I ran to my mother and brother at her desk. My father stood up on the other side of the room. Don't do anything stupid, the leader said as he tapped Daddy's stomach with a gun. Then he said to the mustache man, go get a knife from the kitchen and stay with the wife and kids. He returned with a butcher's knife and sat next to us. He'll stay with them, the leader said, while you take me to go get the money. Stay calm and don't do anything stupid. We're here to deal with you. My father nodded slowly in response. The room was suddenly very quiet. My mother's legs were shaking us as we sat on her lap. The leader poked Daddy's stomach with the gun a few times and led him into the kitchen. The masked man tapped the butcher's knife against the wood of the desk. Tap, 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 tap. All three of us stared down at the tile floor. My mom was trembling all over. Tap, 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 tap. Mom pulled my brother and I closer to her chest. One of us wrapped in each arm. Tap, 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 tap. She continued to look down at the floor as she nervously blurted, I don't want to upset you, but the tapping of the knife is making me nervous. Please stop, I can't take it. Tap, 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 and the knife froze in the air. I'm sorry, ma'am. I didn't mean to upset you, the mustache man said, his words falling over themselves. Don't worry, we're not here to hurt you, he said. She took a deep breath. I know you say that, but it's hard to believe as you tap a knife in front of me. The mustache man turned his chair towards us with the knife still in his gloved right hand. Where do you go to school? He asked me. My mother shook me not to respond, but he asked again. It's okay, I won't hurt you. Do you both go to the same school? My brother and I nodded. What do you want to be when you grow up? He asked. My brother and I looked at each other in silence and then up at our mother's faces, eyes wide. I don't know, I said, and we both shrugged our shoulders as our mother's lap shook beneath us. Please don't hurt my children. Take what you want, but don't hurt my children, she said. No, ma'am, that's not what I came here to do. I just want the money, he said, as he looked her in the eyes. She watched him rest the knife down on the desk away from us. Are they getting good grades, miss? Then he turned to us. You two need to stay in school. So you don't end up like me. I didn't choose this life. This isn't what I wanted to do. But I didn't pay attention in school. So when I finished, I didn't have any opportunities. Now my grandmother is sick, and I have to do this to afford the medication. Stay in school. He looked up at my mother and back at us. Your parents are paying a lot of money for you to go to for you to get an education. Education leads to opportunity. Get a good education. I don't want to see you be like me. My brother and I nodded and glanced at each other from the corner of our eyes. The man with the gun came back into the office with my father. They didn't have it. The safe was empty. My parents ran a car and villa rental company from home, and apparently a rumor had started that they kept $30,000 in the safe in the house. The truth was, the safe just had old papers and a combination they frequently forgot. Are you sure there's nothing else, old man? The man said to my father, who had his hands in the air. His left hand was missing his gold watch and ring. The gun poked him in the back as the robber returned him to the desk. Stay quiet and don't call the police for 10 minutes. If we hear sirens, we'll have to come back. He shook his head. You don't want us to have to come back. The mustache man got up and they left. Daddy asked us, are you okay? The three of us nodded as my mom asked, you? He nodded back, and we sat in silence for a few minutes. When we felt it was safe, my father picked up the phone and called the police. A mix of plain clothes and uniformed officers arrived and separated us for questioning. I saw real guns for the first time. These guns seemed as though they would do real harm, as opposed to the robber's guns, which seemed ornamental. My mom told them I had seen one of the robbers. My dad said, she's a talented artist, to the officer, and turned to me, why don't you draw him? I felt pressured, but I eventually drew a quirky Hitler-esque drawing of a mustache that I knew was useless. The officer took it, looked at it, and said, good job, thank you. A patronizing platitude, I knew it wouldn't help him. And then the next day was school as usual. 2 weeks later, they called my mom to come in with me to the police station. As we drove to the police station, I sat in the front seat. I don't want you to identify the man, she said. It was the opposite of everything Daddy and my brother were saying. While I was a teller at the bank was robbed. I saw his face just like you, and I went into court and testified against him. But he saw me when I testified. At his sentencing, as the officers were carrying him away, he looked at me in the eyes and promised me, I am going to find you, and I am going to kill you when I get out. My testimony put him away. She glanced at me and said, it feels weird saying this, but I was lucky. He died in jail a few years into it. If he hadn't, I'd be living every day in fear. I don't want that for you. But this robber wasn't like that, I responded. Not the one I saw, he was nice. If you testify, he'll see your face, and if he goes to jail, even if it's for a decade, you'll only be in your teens when he gets out. I just don't want you to live your life in fear. But I need you to listen. It's important you don't tell anyone I told you this. The police can say I'm obstructing justice and I can get in trouble. The decision is up to you. A few minutes later, I stood in front of a one-way mirror with the nice robber, clean shaving, and wearing jeans, and a shirt on one side, and me and the two officers on the other. Take your time, the officer said. Look good. I stood in silence for a few minutes. Then I slowly walked the length of the mirror. I figured this would be the only time I'd see this room in my life. The officers watched me and asked, do you see him? I looked at the robber's face one more time and then looked at the officers in the eyes and said, nope, I don't see him. Thank you.
We want to thank the storytellers for sharing these intimate pieces of their lives, the event hosts who welcome us into their homes, and the audiences who come to our shows and listen to this podcast. Music was composed by Arlene Pakulin. And for more information on the podcast, the book, event, or to join our mailing list, please visit storieswedonttell.org.